Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Your Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney. I am thrilled to be hosting you on a tour of a bit of the battle space of what I think of as the war for the free world. We have a great group, as usual, to examine different facets of it, starting with Frank Slazer, a very experienced executive in aerospace industry-related fields, specifically with a focus on space policy. He currently serves as the Vice President for Space Systems at the Aerospace Industries Association. As I say, coming to it from a wealth of experience with some of the principal contractors in this part of the defense industrial base, the space industrial base specifically. And Frank, I'm really pleased to have you with us, in part because we're hearing a lot about what's happening to the space programs of the United States at the moment. Our colleague Robert Zubrin has warned in the Washington Times just yesterday that the Mars exploratory program is essentially being shelved. We've seen the space shuttle, of course, terminated, the reliance now on the Russians to get men into space, at least for the foreseeable future. Give us a sense of what this means, both from the civilian side and, for that matter, the military side of space, as you see it.
Well, I guess my first reaction would be to say that I don't think it's necessarily as apocalyptic as that might sound, although, in fact, if we aren't careful, there are some very troubling trends out there. On the military space side, one of the things that's most concerning to us, the military space procurement budget is down about 22% to about $8 billion in the FY13 request. And that is not, ironically, as bad as it might seem, because some of that includes the fact that an extra satellite was bought last year that takes a couple of years to build, so the production rates and that sort of thing in the supply chain is not quite as bad as that might seem. Another thing that happened was the DWSS, a polar weather satellite for the U.S. Air Force, was canceled, but there's $125 million in there that the Air Force is going to use to reprogram and figure out how to build a less costly system with comparable capability. So to some extent, that's not as troubling. But the concern that we have is that two programs that have been really pivotal to coming up with new innovations, going all the way back to the 1960s in case of the Space Test Program, are being targeted for termination. And the other one is the Operationally Responsive Space System Program. And both of these are really geared at trying to make investments geared towards the future and towards changing risks to our warfighters by developments in other countries.
Yeah. This is a function of the sort of research and development pipeline being constricted. And again, I guess you would call that a trend that could be quite problematic down the road. I just wonder if it's not, in fact, apocalyptic. One of the things that your association has raised an alarm about in the broader space and national security sphere is the kinds of cuts that are now in prospect, in some cases actually in the pipeline, may well result in as many as 1 million jobs being lost in the sort of defense industrial base. That's got to be of profound concern to you, especially if it's beginning even in advance of the so-called sequestration cuts that are now in the law but have not yet been fully accounted for by the Defense Department or the government.
Yeah, there's two categories there. First, because of the budget debt ceiling negotiations last summer, those were about $500 billion, $450 something like that, in cuts to defense over 10 years that were agreed upon. And clearly, this is not something that that industry is pleased about, although, again, it was a bipartisan agreement, and the military posture of the United States has been revised, and the Joint Chiefs and that sort of thing are pretty much on record saying they can live with that. Secretary Panetta is on record saying he can live with that. The problem you face is going forward, of course, we have no deal on how to resolve our spending problem for the future. And if we go into a sequester is an arbitrary cut that was put in there to essentially put a gun to the head of the congressional negotiators on the debt reduction panel. Well, it didn't work, and they came up with no agreement. And it right now is scheduled to go into place starting January 2nd to start about a 10% cut in FY13. Now, of course, FY13 starts in October, so the near-term impact would be greater. And you take away from that also that some things like retirement plans, TRICARE, things like that, can't really be cut short-term because those are long-term programs. And you may wind up with a very severe and disproportionate impact on investments and on procurement of the hardware we need to support our military. And that's where that million jobs comes from over a 10-year period if that little cut goes into place.
Right. I think you've described the background here very well. As a matter of fact, Frank Slaver, it's perhaps as well explained as I've heard it by anybody, and the kinds of implications that it might have, both for the defense industries that you represent at the Aerospace Industries Association, where you serve as a vice president, and for that matter, more broadly on the economy of many of the states and communities around the country, is the subject of a study that we've done at the Center for Security Policy. As you perhaps are aware of, it can be found, folks, at ForTheCommonDefense.com. It's a simple breakdown of how those kinds of cuts would apply, particularly this second round of so-called sequestration cuts, and the kind of impact that they would have on jobs and on the economy directly and indirectly, including lots of smaller minority-owned, veterans-owned, and so on businesses. This is the sort of thing that we think legislators in particular, Frank, ought to have a handle on as they're deciding whether to allow this this gun pointed at their heads to actually be triggered. Let me ask you a related question, if I can. And of course, you've been following this, I know, most immediately in the space arena, Frank Slaser. But I think you can probably extrapolate reasonably well to the defense enterprise more broadly. As a function of trying to cut costs, and with the kind of, the expatriation, shall we say, of a lot of industrial capabilities to lower cost manufacturing locations in places like China, we've found ourselves, it seems, increasingly relying upon foreign supplied parts, components, equipment, in even some sensitive areas, I imagine in the space arena as well as in the military more generally. Can you comment on the advisability, as a guy who spent a lot of time at companies like Boeing and Northrop Grumman, working, you know, in the defense sector, the advisability of such reliance going forward?
Yeah, I think it's inadvisable in a couple of ways. And first of all, is obviously the risk you may get, you know, parts that aren't good quality or that, you know, maybe even get potentially sabotaged. So I think it's more likely you're worried about having the quality control of your supply chain. But the other thing that's important about it is your industrial base. The people that develop the traveling wave tubes for a satellite or thrusters or what have you, the ones that are producing them and working out the processes and getting the manufacturing proficiencies, are the ones that are going to be best able to innovate in the future. And so securing that entire food chain of production of capabilities for vital systems is really important. And as budgets start turning down, even if we don't do a sequester, which hopefully we'll not, and we'll just have to worry about the $450 million or so they've already agreed upon, billion that we've already agreed upon, that's one of the reasons why we've been promoting export control reform, because we see a commercial market out there that is growing for commercial satellites, but it's more difficult for our companies to compete for that precisely because they've got extra hurdles even for technologies that are commercially available in the broader space marketplace. And it all works into a food chain of providing support for these companies. Now, not every technology can be exported, certainly not, but the same company that makes something that can't be exported probably also has production lines that could and keeps that, the overall health of that industrial enterprise going if you've got the ability to export in that big growing market.
Yeah. We spoke, as it happens, with one of our regular contributors yesterday, Gordon Chang, on this point about export control, and we're just out of time right now to get into this with you, Frank Slaver. But I hope you'll come back, because I must say I'm very concerned, as I know Gordon is, about the seeming willingness of the Obama administration now to be moving in the direction of making a lot of technologies, some of which you might even consider to be too sensitive, too dual use, I certainly do, to be making them available to people who might well use them against us. But that's for another day. Frank Slaser, again, the Vice President at the Aerospace Industries Association, I appreciate very much you taking some time and the important work you all do. Keep it up, and please keep coming back to us, as we value very much your contributions. Next up, we'll be speaking with Elaine Donnelly about the Obama administration's assault on the culture of the military. It gives a culture war a whole new meaning. Straight ahead.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit shariathethreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, the Threat to America at amazon.com.
Congress doesn't have a budget for 2011, but the GOP has proposed a budget for 2012, and Bill Bennett likes it.
Maybe it helps to have that 2012 in the background, people hearing and seeing Ryan and the Republicans saying they're serious about really cutting the budget
as a backdrop
to this debate about 2011. People make the decision, well, Republicans seem much more serious about this.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. I'm very pleased to say, joined by a highly esteemed colleague, a woman I've been privileged to call a friend, whom I admire enormously. Elaine Donnelly is her name. She has been the driving force behind a terrific organization called the Center for Military Readiness. It has been championing for years, back as far as I can remember, for sure, since 1993, I think, is when you started it up, Elaine. The whole idea of the integrity of the military that is rooted in no small measure in its culture. And that's a concept that probably most civilians have really no appreciation for, but I think that's certainly a very important part of what makes our military the finest in the world, has to date. And assaults on it, which is seemingly what's afoot here under the Obama administration, are assuredly a threat to that fine military that we have. So let's start, Elaine Donnelly, if we can, with kind of a microcosmic example of what's afoot here. A study recently done by the Pentagon that they didn't seem to want to advertise some of the bad news in it, but you found it. Tell us about it.
Well, hiding in plain sight is an absolutely jaw-dropping chapter or section of a report that came out in January. It's titled Generating Health and Discipline in the Force Ahead of the Strategic Reset. Pretty clunky name. It's called the Gold Book for short. In this report, there is a section about violent sex crime, and it says in there that the incidence of these crimes has nearly doubled since 2006, rising from 663 to 1,313 last year, the FY 2011. This is a new report. Now, you would think something like this would make headlines. Well, it turns out that the news release that came out with this report on January 19 didn't even mention this section. And a covering letter from the vice chief of the Army at the time, Peter Chiarelli, who recently resigned, he didn't mention it either. So if
and there's you told me there's apparently no executive summary to this document.
No,
I can't remember
summary.
Something like that out of the
Pentagon.
That
is very, very unusual.
Yeah. So presumably this is bad news, obviously, but they're not interested in most of us knowing about it. You tumbled upon it, and give us a flavor of what the implications are of this kind of assault on women that's taking place. I mean, how do they find themselves in that kind of position in the first place?
Well,
and what's being done about it?
Well, these figures clearly are contrary to the template of what the Pentagon was preparing to announce just a few weeks later, and that is the push to put women in or near, actually in, direct ground combat units, battalions, infantry and marine infantry battalions, special operations forces, pretending that sexuality doesn't matter, physical differences don't matter, it's all about careers, it's all about diversity. The Diversity Commission that was established by Congress, actually began in the Bush administration, is pushing hard to eliminate all the exemptions of women from direct ground combat. And in order to do that, they had to take a report like this, hide it in plain sight, don't mention it, hope nobody would mention or notice it, and then proceed along this path that is going to make this problem much worse, not better.
Now,
the rate
Elaine,
of violent sex crime is accelerating, but they're trying to pretend that's not happening.
Let's, again, back the lens up a little bit here, because you've been wrestling with these issues practically, if not actually full-time, as I can tell, going back to your service, distinguished service, let me add, on the Defense Advisory Committee on Women in the Services, known as Dakowitz, back in 1984, trying to figure out, no kidding, what are the implications of bringing women into the force in the kind of numbers they're in now, let alone pushing them ever more and more into, well, dangerous missions and assignments. Give us a flavor of how, over the space of your working on these issues, you've seen this trajectory. And again, does it make any more sense today than when you were working on it at the beginning?
No, it doesn't. What is confirmed in this report, which is brutally frank, unlike many of the things that comes out of the Pentagon, in which women are always the victims, men are always the perpetrators, this one tells you what the numbers are, and it's unvarnished. And there's graphs that also show trend lines that are accelerating and becoming worse. They use the phrase chilling trend. This chilling trend suggests that the increase in offenses going forward will likely continue. I'm quoting from the report. It talks about how these offenses usually happen in what they call high-density housing, the barracks. It happens most often on the weekend. Alcohol, people living in high-density housing or going to parties nearby. All of these are key components and scenarios that create what they call the opportunity for incapacitation and seclusion of potential victims. Now, to me, this is common sense. We've known this for a long time. But this is the first time I've seen it so brutally described in a report, and they even go into the ways that men are abused as well by false accusations. False accusations certainly occur, but I think this evidence of real sexual assault and violence in the military against our women, especially when they're brand new to a unit, it describes how when they go into a new unit and they're not socialized or brought in by leadership, that's when they're most vulnerable. Now, just last week, the Pentagon said, well, we have this problem with sexual assault, so our solution is this. If anybody complains, they can be immediately removed from the unit. Well, what good does that do if they become a new person in another unit where they are equally vulnerable, if not more so? And here's the big question. How does all this turmoil improve the effectiveness of direct ground combat infantry battalions? These are the tip of the spear units. If you start to transfer all of these issues and problems into those small units, you're going to really do great harm to the culture, how things are done in our military.
To say nothing, Elaine, if I can, it just screams out at you from a common sense point of view. You're talking about a huge churning, potentially, of people through units as a result of this kind of difficulty and trying to contend with it. And, you know, it can't possibly be good for the readiness of the unit, the morale of the unit, the mission performance of the unit.
Well,
and that's that's really what we've only got a couple of minutes left, Elaine Donnelly. Let me just quickly ask you, again, back the lens up still further. We've had the gaze in the military assault on the culture of the armed forces. We've got the budgets being slashed, the units, many of them are now facing contraction, the services, I should say. We're looking at, obviously, as you mentioned, possible, you know, impacts on the health care and on the other benefits and retirement plans of that have been promised to the military. Are we at risk, Elaine Donnelly of the Center for Military Readiness, of breaking the all-volunteer force with all
this? Yes, we are. And what we're heading toward is what I call the Jenga block military. If you've ever played that game with wooden blocks, you know you take the blocks out of the bottom and you load more burdens on the top. Eventually, the tower becomes so unstable, it collapses. And it's a fun game to play on your kitchen table. But if you take things away from our military and you keep adding social burdens on top, what you do is make a weakened force. You make that tower unstable. You, in essence, weaken the infrastructure of the culture of the military. And let's face it, it isn't just about the weapons and the planes and ships and all of those hardware things. It's the people who defend the military, the all-volunteer force. If we are doing great harm to both women and men in the military, if sexual assaults become so demoralizing, so conducive to indiscipline, what we're doing is weakening the finest military in the world. We're doing it gradually. And according to this Army report, the progression is relentless, and it's going in the wrong direction. It's getting worse, and we certainly should not make it even worse than that by placing female soldiers into direct ground combat infantry battalions. Somebody's got to blow the whistle on this. Social engineers never are held accountable for their handiwork. Instead, the Pentagon invites them in to do more mischief, to create more problems. They don't know what they're doing. This report indicates that we need to really analyze this thing, and frankly, Congress needs to intervene before it is too late.
Yeah. Elaine Donnelly, your calls to arms on these kinds of issues, as I say, going back decades now, are deeply appreciated, as is the Center for Military Readiness. Please keep up what you're doing and making clear to all of us what this social engineering, the imposition of the social agenda the Obama administration means for the military and therefore for all of us, because at the end of the day, those guys are providing for our security. Thanks so much for joining us. Great to talk with you. Next
Thank
up,
you,
we'll
Frank.
Be speaking with a former senior State Department official and Fox News contributor, Christian White, about Obama's next war. Syria. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hey, parents. Finding it hard to communicate with kids in today's world of ever-changing slang?
Hi, son.
Excuse me?
Introducing the Communicizer. Just strap non-toxic Communicizer to your mouth and go from boring old man speak.
You know, I'm here if you want to talk.
To 100% off the chain.
Text me whenever, yo.
It's that easy.
Thanks to Communicizer, I'm relevant to my kids again. I mean, I'll fly, boo.
And now when you buy Communicizer, you get the auto-tune attachment free. Sounds so hip-hop, your kids will want to talk to you for hours.
I used to have to walk 3 miles uphill to school every morning, shorty.
I love you, Dad.
I love you too, son.
Communicizer is not available in stores because it doesn't exist. But that's okay. You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Because kids in foster care don't need perfection. They need you. For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUsKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt Us Kids, and the Ad Council.
For decades, the Democratic Republic of Congo has endured economic collapse, poverty, and war. More than 3.5 million people have died in the conflict. Today, rebel forces continue to wreak havoc in the eastern Kivu provinces. The International Rescue Committee estimates that 30,000 children have been recruited as soldiers, and thousands more have lost their parents. Most of these children lack the most basic level of goods, security, and most especially, clean drinking water. Yet, there is a well of hope coming to eastern Congo in a village called Uvira. Washington, D.C.'s National Community Church is partnering with Global Outreach to bring a water pipeline to the Congo for Christ compound, an orphanage for children who have lost their parents to war and AIDS. Building a clean water source will sustain the school, provide for the children, and hundreds more in the village. Go to www.waterforcongo.com. Learn about the work of Global Outreach and give. You can be part of the community in Uvira, and like a well, you can be a source of hope in life. www.waterforcongo.com.
Hi, I'm Drew Brees, NFL quarterback for the New Orleans Saints, here with Bugs Bunny to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you fuel your body and your mind.
So what do you like to throw around the football like Drew?
Skateboard.
Play frisbee in the park.
Ride a bike.
Kick the soccer ball around.
Or dance in your room.
Just move it your way.
Because nothing makes you feel better than moving every day.
And that makes you part of a winning team.
So be a player.
You'll have more energy to do the things you like to do.
Move it your way and be a player.
Get up and play an hour a day, Doc. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
That's right, at letsmove.gov. Let's hear that one more time, Doc. That's www.letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
I'll pick you up after school. Okay, I got it.
It's easy to take a day for granted. You and your family are connected by routine, and you stick to it. But what if a disaster strikes without warning? What if life as you know it has completely turned on its head? What if your day's routine is disrupted and you can't reach your family? Have you planned for that? Before a disaster turns your family's world upside down, it's up to you to be ready. Get a kit, make a plan, be informed today. Learn how at www.ready.gov. Ready.gov. This message brought to you by the Federal Emergency Management Agency and the Ad Council.
You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined by Christian Whiten, a man who we're pleased to have with us from time to time, bringing a very important perspective, that of a man who served in the belly of the beast in the State Department and who has, I'm hoping, some clarity as to what's going on the seventh floor there now, with respect in particular, Christian, to Syria. A matter that, if my reading of this is right, seems to be ratcheting up inexorably to the point where we may well find ourselves not only throwing money into a war, but possibly being drawn into it ourselves. What's going on, in your estimation?
Well, that's right. It's not just that, of course. It's that without a strategy, which is sort of par for course now with Arab Spring. You know, this has been going on for more than a year, so you sort of have to wonder what changed within the administration, what changed in Syria, if it's the case again where it's Secretary Clinton, possibly with Secretary Panetta, being the slightly more hawkish people in the administration, if you will, versus the Obama White House. But yeah, a lack of clarity. What does seem to have changed, you know, perhaps more leading from behind, because you had a conference in Istanbul, meeting of friends of the Syrian people. It's the second such meeting over the weekend, and you had Secretary Clinton go through Riyadh. And the Saudis and the Qataris are thinking now, at least reports are, that they are thinking of arming elements of the opponents of Assad. And, of course, the Turks, because this war is in their backyard, wanting to do more, they switched. Erdogan, ever being the populist, the prime minister of Turkey, switched.
The Islamist populist.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. Well, and that's the big question, of course, is which way is Turkey going? And, you know, that's an interesting sub-angle there, Frank, is that Turkey is leaning on the representatives, the Syrian council, the representatives of the rebels, to have a less Islamist face. And you wonder if that's just as much yard work to be done in advance of more public scrutiny, or whether they actually want it to be more representative of the Syrian opposition and, God forbid, have some reformers and liberals involved. So it's a very opaque situation. And once again, we seem to be marching to some greater level involvement without a strategy, and certainly without a strategy having been explained to the American people.
Yeah, well, that the latter's for sure. Christian White, let me just ask you, because I think on my darker days, that there actually is a strategy. I mean, it may not be very coherent or certainly consistent with our national interests, but the strategy, such as it is, seems to be to do what the Muslim Brotherhood, and for that matter, other Islamists, want us to do. And by and large, what that means is get rid of people who aren't theirs and bring to power people who are. And as you know, Christian, what we've been watching inexorably, again, play out in Egypt is the sort of greater and greater transparency about what the Brotherhood's agenda is there. Namely, any representations that they really weren't going to try to grab onto all aspects of power, you know, fall by the way. And lo and behold, they're working to get a hold of all aspects of power. And presumably that's what they have in mind in places like Syria as well, don't they?
I think so. You have a naive belief in the State Department, but also on Capitol Hill, including some places, some precincts of Capitol Hill that you might think are more hawkish, that the Muslim Brotherhood can be partnered with. These are people we can deal with. They've come in from the cold. They're not really Islamists, even though they invented Islamism, modern Islamism. And yes, so they say things like, gee, we're not going to run for the presidency of Egypt, in a way to assuage their opponents. But then, lo and behold, this week we've discovered they are, in fact, going to run a candidate. And judging from their past prowess at winning elections just by mastering the ground game, providing services as Islamists like Hezbollah do, in Lebanon, the Muslim Brotherhood handing out jars of cooking oil and winning votes that way. In Egypt, and liberals being, reformers being completely disorganized. You know, you go back and look at the end of the Cold War. Of course, we helped out the opponents of the repressive party, the opponents of communism. We're not doing that in this case. We're actually siding with one faction of the bad guys in the belief that they're better than other factions. And I mean, to an extent, I guess the Muslim Brotherhood is preferable slightly to the Salafists. But these are sort of birds of a feather.
And I don't think a dime's worth the difference, Christian, between the two, frankly. And it seems like it really is mostly a bit of bait and switch. We're speaking again with Christian White, and he is currently with DC International Advisory, LLC. He served as a senior State Department official from 2003 to 2009, and you see him frequently at Fox News, and you are reading his various essays in all of the right places. And Christian, let me just segue if I can, because I think whatever the administration's strategy toward the Middle East is, it's pretty clear what its strategy has been towards Russia. This whole notion of reset is the rubric under which it's being conducted. But since we last talked, of course, we had the what's been described as a gaffe, what I think of as a providential insight into this presidency in the off-record but on-mic comments between President Obama and President Medvedev of Russia. Give us a flavor of what, as a former senior State Department figure, you make of those comments and, more generally, the administration's policies towards Russia.
I think it is very revealing. It was a moment of clarity, an unintended moment of clarity. And clearly the president has in mind to concede something else on missile defense. I think that's the unmistakable implication of what was said. They've tried to downplay this, say, oh, well, all presidents have more latitude in their second term. But the way he said it, you know, in the sense that he is conspiring with Russia's leader, or at least sidekick leader, and not allowing the American people in on the conspiracy, it's very alarming. And then the question is, what does he intend to get from conceding anything on missile defense? Which, you know, the Russians, it's funny, they've been behind us on missile defense from the beginning, going back to the 80s and beyond, and they just must just kick themselves with glee that we keep negotiating our advantages away, whether it's in strategic arms overall or strategic defense. You know, the theory in the first term, I think, was so you reset relations with Russia and you get all this magnificent cooperation on everything. That hasn't materialized, especially on where we needed it most in the top ask, which was cooperation on Afghanistan. We still have not transshipped significantly any lethal goods through Russia on the way to Afghanistan. And Russia hasn't been useful in the UN Security Council. Go down the list of things we asked for. So they got a nice
Iran, not least. Yeah.
Exactly. And they continue to supply Syria and Iran with antecedents of WMD, you know, up the line reactor parts and things like that.
Right. So, let's broaden the lens here. These are just two examples of what seemed to me, Christian Wyden, to be a long and growing bill of particulars in terms of a terribly failed presidency when it comes to national security policy. We were talking in previous segments about the dismantling of the defense industrial base and the assault on the culture of the military. You've added to this litany. Are we getting anything remotely like the kind of attention on these issues, given the stakes involved, that we should in the course of this election season, given that, you know, the proposition here fundamentally is, will we rehire this guy as commander-in-chief come November?
Right. No, I don't think this has been getting as much attention as it ought to be, because there are some serious threats out there. Of course, there's the Iran threat, and you've done a fantastic job of highlighting that, and that's one that gets ever near. There's the China threat. You know, we are basically having war waged upon us. It's a cyber war, but it, you know, could be essentially a 21st century Pearl Harbor brought to our doorstep by China. Yet the Chinese leader comes to the White House and is feted in, you know, magnificent ceremony, and the president doesn't even mention this once, and you have other threats like North Korea. The list goes on. But, you know, here I'd be an equal opportunity critic and say that both sides actually of our Washington foreign policy establishment haven't offered compelling solutions to the American people. Republicans have seen foreign policy largely as a liability since 2006, and you have people who, for one reason or another, are considered bigwigs in the Republican Party, John McCain, come out and have his one-size-fits-all solution of a no-fly zone over Syria, which is just another way of saying that we should go to war over Syria. So I think there's a lot of fatigue and just cynicism on the part of the American people with foreign policy, which is too bad, because their center of balance, you know, how you deal with bullies, how you deal with threats, I think is a very good center of balance. And if you apply it to foreign policy, it would actually be a lot better than what our foreign policy establishment comes up with, certainly better than the Obama administration.
How perfect to close on a good sideswipe at the elite in this foreign policy establishment. Christian Wyden knows a bit about that team, as he's played with him in the past. He's a senior State Department official in the Bush administration, now with D.C. International Advisory. Thanks so much, Christian, for this assessment of where we are and the call to arms. We need to be talking about these things, folks. It's what we do here every day, but we need you to be talking about them, particularly with people who would replace this commander-in-chief. We'll be speaking with Andy McCarthy about the stealth jihad underway here in the United States. Another thing our elected officials should be talking about. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I went from a size 18 down to a size 5, and I was able to keep it off.
Angie had some serious challenges.
I had gone through a divorce and put on quite a bit of weight. There was an accident where I was put on a lot of medication, and I put on over 60 pounds. I tried every kind of diet. The diets just did not work.
Diets don't work is something they hear a lot over at the MetaSystem from Judy Singer.
I heard about Judy Singer's MetaSystem, and I thought, well, you know, couldn't hurt to call. And I called them up, and they told me all about the product. And I thought, well, I'll give it a try. From the first week that I was on it, I wasn't hungry a lot, and it was just amazing. Jumping about 3 months ahead, I dropped 63 pounds.
If you're ready for a natural product that cleanses your system and helps you lose fat, talk to a Judy Singer counselor about the MetaSystem. Call 1-800-711-JUDY. 1-800-711-JUDY. The MetaSystem from Judy Singer. Powerful, all-natural weight loss. 1-800-711-JUDY.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Is Nancy Pelosi looking to a higher power to get a balanced budget? Hugh Hewitt sets her straight.
When I hear you speak about this issue, of course, it's the Gospel of Matthew. When I was hungry, you gave me to eat and listen.
I just got to stop here. Nancy Pelosi quoting the Gospel of Matthew, as though that's got anything to do with the government. Let me just tell you, it doesn't.
Can I get an amen?
The Hugh Hewitt Show, weeknights from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone.
At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there.
So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need, and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill,
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home,
or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org.
Even if it's just everyday stuff.
Like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say
sweater?
That?
Really? What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back as we have the high privilege of being each week with Andy McCarthy, the former federal prosecutor of the first attack on the World Trade Center. He is also an author of great skill and a proven track record with Willful Blindness and The Grand Jihad, two best-selling books. He's also an essayist par excellence, National Review Online, and a regular here at Secure Freedom. Andy, great to have you with us, as always.
Frank, great to be here, as always.
Let's talk a little bit about something that we've been trying to raise an alarm about. Nobody understands better than you, I think, the stealth or civilization jihad of the Muslim Brotherhood. So give us a sense of how a $3 million nationwide PR campaign run by the Islamic Circle of North America fits into that stealthy form of jihad.
Well, it really is remarkable, Frank, what they figure they can get away with, and perhaps rightly. The ICNA, the Islamic Circle of North America, is the prototype Muslim Brotherhood organization. And that's worth noting because we have another prototype Muslim Brotherhood organization, the International Institute of Islamic Thought, which is actually signed off on an English version of what classical Sharia is, Reliance of the Traveler. So there's really not a lot of mystery about what these people really think Sharia holds. So the thought that they'd now have a $3 million campaign to convince us, notwithstanding the notorious reputation that ICNA actually has as an Islamist organization, to convince us that Sharia means something different from what they not only have said it means, but have written down that it means, is somewhat astounding.
In practice.
Yeah, I mean, it does say a lot about what they think of us and how convinced they are. And I think, unfortunately, they're right in this regard, how convinced they are that as a society, we don't go to school on them, even though, you know, they've gone to graduate school on us.
Right. I guess it comes down to this, Andy McCarthy, that we've got certainly evidence of their contempt for us. And as you've sort of suggested, their expectation with considerable reason that we will submit to whatever it is they tell us they're about. And I guess the really interesting thing to me, and Andy, given your background with particularly national security law, it must be of great concern to you, is the extent to which they are perfecting these Muslim Brotherhood front organizations, the practice of using our civil liberties, the freedom of speech as an example, against us as part of this, what they call themselves in their, as you know, their strategic plan, civilization jihad.
Yeah, well, I think they mirror, Frank, the manner in which the left uses the Constitution. And it's not surprising to me that as we've talked about before, my book, The Grand Jihad, in part is about how Islamists and leftists work together, and they ape not only some of each other's goals, but also each other's tactics. But, you know, when the left uses the Constitution, the parts of the Constitution they like, and there actually are one or two, those are thought to be sacrosanct, and they become the world's biggest strict constructionist, as they put it. And everything else is organic and living, and the fact that it's written down a certain way doesn't mean anything. So it's all subject to negotiation. So basically, it's kind of like we used to say in the law, that you can use something as a sword, but not as a shield, but not a sword. They use our law and our civil liberties protections as a sword, not a shield. In other words, when it works for them, they use it as an offensive weapon. And when it works against them, it's all subject to negotiation, and it's not really law at all. So it's quite a game as long as you can get away with it.
And they've had a terrific run of it, and still are, as this $3 million campaign presumably will suggest. Andy, speaking of the left and the Constitution, I just have to ask you, it's a little bit off of our general topic, but it certainly has bearing on our constitutional republic and its future viability and security, for that matter. And that is the statement that the president made yesterday in response to a rather bad week for his team before the Supremes on health care. And he sounded, a lot like a strict constructionist, didn't he, and reviling judicial activism, of all things. Give us your take on that.
Well, I was sort of wondering how far the president wants to take the logic of what he said. You know, the people in Arizona passed a Democratic fully, what was his term, a fully constituted democratic law on immigration, and that didn't stop his Justice Department from hauling them into court. So, you know, I'm sort of perplexed by what his standard is. Obviously, the president thinks...
I think it's double is the point.
Well, at least double. Yeah. But I think that, you know, he obviously thinks that the individual mandate, at the very least, and maybe all of Obamacare, is in some trouble. I'm not holding my breath on that. I'm not as optimistic as other people are, but let's see what happens. That'll come in July. But I think, in terms of what you're asking me, the more interesting thing about President Obama's unique in American experience way of politics, which is sort of community organizer, comes to the White House. This is not the first time we've seen something like this. The president basically tried to intimidate the Supreme Court in a State of the Union address that he gave a couple of years ago after a decision that he didn't like. And if you think back just a few months ago, despite the fact that Congress was formally in session, he made three controversial controversial recess appointments, and basically dared the legislature to do what the framers always assumed that the legislature would do, which is to guard the prerogatives of a legislature, even if they ideologically agreed with the executive branch. The framers assumed that each branch of the government would defend its turf, and I think they didn't anticipate the modern left, which plays an entirely different game.
Yeah, the triumph of ideology over the national interest. Andy, speaking of which, let me turn to a subject that we've addressed a couple of times now in the past few months, and I guess in the way of a stock taking. I had your friend Dick Morris on the show yesterday. We didn't actually get into it in our segment, but he'd recently had written a piece about this National Defense Authorization Act last year and its putative authority to the president to round up and indefinitely detain U.S. citizens, point one. And point two, the recent executive order, I can't find a number for it, but I know it amends 12919.
Yeah, 13 dated, dot, 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 something around.
Okay,
way.
Well, it's March 16th, 2012, folks, if you're looking for it, talking about national defense resources preparedness. Both of these, we're being told, really constitute major departures from past practice and a threat to civil liberties and to constitutional republicanism. Tell us what your current reading is on these things, Andy.
Well, I saw Dick's piece on that, and I thought that, he's a very sharp guy, but I think he made an error in lumping the two of them together, because the first one...
He's not alone in doing that.
Yeah, no, I know that. And rhetorically, it works for people who want to make this populist pitch about liberty, a lot of which, by the way, I agree with. But the first thing we're talking about is an act of Congress. That is the Defense Authorization Act. And the offensive parts of it, really, the Obama administration actually disagreed with. But it really codified what was already going on under the Bush administration. I know that people claim that that's not true, but in my view, it is true, and I've written about this somewhere.
Yes, I know you have. So that's still your position.
Yeah, the second one is an executive order, and that's a unilateral Obama deal. It's not at all, I don't think, to be confused with an act of Congress. And you have to wonder what it is that made the president do this at this time, because it certainly does lay the groundwork to put the nation on a national security emergency footing, absent what appears to be anything
national security emergency.
National security.
And this is going to be a subject for a longer conversation. We also saw a piece by Ed Morrissey recently in which he said, "Look, it's just same old. It's what others have basically presidents have done before." I really want to spend some time with both of you, if we can, thinking this through, getting it right. And I appreciate, as always, your doing that with us each week, and we look forward to doing it again next. And I also look forward to talking with the rest of you tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.